Welcome to Perspectives. I'm Joan Herman. Every year in the United States, some 700,000 children suffer abuse and neglect. To regain custody of their children in foster care, parents must learn how to be safe and sober. Ultimately, the children's future is decided in a courtroom. Thanks to volunteer court-appointed special advocates, or CASAs, for the past 40 years, children have had a champion in their corner to help inform the court about that decision. My two guests today will explain the Clatsop CASAs program and an upcoming training to recruit new advocates. Julia Mabry, a native of Berlin, Germany, and an Astoria resident since 1999, joined the Clatsop CASAs program in 2014 and has been the executive director since January of 2016. She has an MS in Fisheries from the University of Alaska, Fairbanks, and a Master of Public Health from San Jose State University. Charlie Clayton, who grew up in Astoria, is a retired Air Force pilot and Boeing flight instructor who taught commercial pilots how to fly Boeing's newest airliners. Since becoming a volunteer CASA advocate in January 2014, he has been assigned 6 cases involving 8 children. Welcome to the studio, Julia and Charlie.
Good morning. Pleasure to be here.
Happy to be here.
Julia, would you explain what CASAs is in a little more detail and why it is needed?
Yeah, so when children enter the foster care system, they are assigned an attorney, their parents are assigned an attorney, and the family also has a Department of Health and Human Services, a child welfare caseworker. And they all try to reunify the family. What the CASA's role is, the volunteer's role is to look at what in that whole process is in the best interest of the child. So the attorney for the child advocates for what the child wants. The attorneys for the parents advocate for what the parent wants. And the CASA's unique role is really just to look at, well, what is truly in this child's best interest.
And what are the most common reasons that children are placed in the foster care system?
The most common reasons that we see here in our county are parents' substance abuse, including methamphetamine, heroin, and other substances. We also see quite a bit of domestic violence that children are exposed to. Domestic violence is incredibly damaging to children to witness. So that can be a reason for children to be removed from parents. Mental health on the parents' part, if they have mental illnesses that are untreated, then they can often not be a safe parent until they seek treatment.
And in Clatsop County, how many children are we talking about?
So right now we have 93 children that have an open dependency case. So,
and how many CASA volunteers, court-appointed advocates, do you have now?
Right now we have about 35.
And how many more are you looking for?
We would love to train 20.
And explain a little bit about the training. Either one of you, Charlie, you've been through it.
First of all, it was a little bit scary to enter something like this. It was going to be in courtrooms. It was going to involve the welfare of children, meeting people I hadn't known or met before. But the training is so well done. It took 6 weeks to go through the training in evening classes. We did it up at Clatsop College at the time. Staff of CASA here does such an excellent job of covering so much of the material. There's no one particular type of case. There's so many. It's different for each child. And they just do a wonderful job of giving you a general background of how the court system works, about the children and what gets them to this place. And then near the end of that training, you actually get to practice doing a report for the court. And we even went in and observed a court session to see how it goes. That took a lot of that apprehension away. And the staff has just been wonderful since then. Anytime there's a question or I feel a little uncomfortable about something, I talk to the CASA staff and go away feeling much safer, much more secure.
That's
about
great.
What I'm doing.
Did you have any legal background at all?
No legal background at all.
So what drew you to become a CASA volunteer?
The children. We're just now finding out that they're having the same symptoms of PTSD that our soldiers do who return from
really?
The Middle East and so forth, from the trauma that they've experienced, at some of them from birth. And it just breaks my heart for a child to be going through that. And the constant changes moving from parent to foster home and so forth. And I found that my favorite part of it is being the constant. If I am a CASA from near the beginning of the time they enter foster care until the time that their case is resolved, I'm the one person. I don't have 50 cases or 100 cases that I'm responsible for. I have one or two, and I get to be a constant in that child's life, and that's very gratifying.
Now, you've mentioned that when you first became a volunteer, you weren't sure that you would have an impact on the child's life or that you could be influential in the courtroom. Do you still feel that way?
I definitely do not feel that way. But you're right. In the beginning, I thought, I have no legal training. I have no experience in court other than serving on jury duty once. How could I measure up against all the knowledge and power that was in there? But over the last 4 years and a couple of cases where I really felt like the other lawyers and the judge listened to what I had to say, and things went the direction I thought was best for the child. And it was quite the feeling you get out afterwards. Kind of like soloing the airplane the first time. It's after you land that your knees start to shake. And it's the same way after that first court
really?
Case when you walk out and you think, wow, I really had an impact in there. Almost scary to realize the power that you can have in a child's life. It's a wonderful scary, though.
So, Julia, you mentioned that the child does have a court-appointed attorney. So how is the CASA advocate different from that? What are they doing that the court-appointed attorney isn't or can't?
So an attorney for the child, as any attorney, is obligated to act within their professional code of ethics. And for attorneys, that means advocating for what their client wants. And even though a home may not be safe or a parent may not be safe, very many children in foster care, what they truly want is to return to that parent. And so it's not always up to the attorney to advocate for what is best for the child.
Okay. So what might you be advocating for that an attorney can't, Charlie?
Well, the children always think, they just imagine that mom and dad are going to get back together and they'll be a family again. But I can see that the mother and or father is not willing to do what they need to do in order to make the home safe for the child. And over a period of time, you hate to see a child languish in foster care for 6 or 8 years while the parent tries to get together. And so it would be advocating maybe for one parent over the other, or even advocating that that the child be adopted in a loving, caring home that would give it some stability.
Are drugs usually at the heart of these problems?
Not for all cases, but for many. So we do have cases where the parents have no involvement with substances whatsoever, and other issues are in the forefront, like mental illness. We have some cases where parents are so mentally ill that they cannot currently parent, and there may be no drug involvement at all. But very many cases do involve some form of substance abuse. And the majority of the cases that we deal with, the majority of parents who have kids in foster care have multiple problems. So it's not just substance abuse. It's not just domestic violence. It's an array of things. Sometimes it's just lack of parenting skills because they never learned how to parent themselves.
Are there services for them so that they can hopefully, with a goal of unifying the family, or at least doing what's best for the children so the parents can have some involvement with the children later on, even if they're not caring for the children full time. Are there services for them?
Yes, absolutely. And at the beginning of a case, the judge will make orders for the parents to follow and for the DHS caseworker to follow with the parents. And often that includes the parents are ordered into substance abuse treatment or mental health treatment or They have to do parenting classes, all these things. What most of the time, what we all want is for parents to get better. We want them to be safe and sober. They love their children. The children love them. So we want them back together. So it's when we talk about abuse and neglect, more often we're talking about neglect, which is very harmful to children. Drugs can lead to a lot of neglect of children. So we're not necessarily talking about physical abuse, although that does happen in some cases. So we're not talking about people who are mean and abusing their children. We're talking about people who don't have the ability to parent at this time. They need help becoming better parents. And yes, the judge orders that, and the parents can follow those orders and regain the custody of their children. That is what we all hope for.
Do you have a sense of what percentage of cases that happens?
Yeah, in our county, about 60% of kids that enter foster care are returned to their parents.
And do you know how that works out? Do the children end up recycling back through the foster care system?
So if they re-enter foster care in our county, we know that because we have history with them and we learn about that. I would say it's 1-2 at the most a year.
Okay, so not so that many.
Yeah, it's few.
The sad thing about most of the parents that I've seen that have a drug problem, the sad part of it is in I think almost all of the cases, the parent really truly loves the child and wants to be reunified with the child. But unfortunately, especially parents that have started their drug exposure at an early age, teenage or early 20s, they do permanent damage to their brain with the drugs. Even marijuana can do permanent damage. And unfortunately, that last part of the brain that develops is the part that lets you reason and understand cause and effect. And so I can see them in court, crying, brokenhearted. They want their child back. They'll do anything for that child. And then that night they will go out and feel so sad, they just have to get that next dose of the drugs, which just works the wrong direction for what they think and say they want. But I really have come to believe that there's just, like Julia said, an inability to grasp the scope of what they're doing to harm their child. And those are the saddest cases.
How do you keep yourself from getting really despondent as a volunteer?
You go see the children. You feel sad for the children, but it's just it's all about the children. You have to. I just feel I have to keep going to ensure what's best for the child. In some cases, the tough part of the decision is I've seen a child in just a wonderful foster home with other children around and everything, and yet the mother did everything that was required to get this child back. And though it was sad to see the child leave this wonderful child-filled environment to go back to be an only child with the mother, we know that that's the right thing. The child, if it's all at all possible, should be back with the mother. And sometimes that's a harder decision than some of the others, knowing that child belongs back with the parent again.
All right. So I'm curious, how is it that you know what recommendations to make to the court? What is it that happens from the time you are assigned a case as a volunteer advocate to the point where you're in the courtroom telling the judge, this is what I believe the child needs?
For me, that's somewhat fluid in most of the cases because the parents may be changing during that time, changing their opinion of what they want. The happiest is when I see the parent actually come to an understanding of what they need to do to satisfy the state in order to get their child back, in order to become a better parent. And then sometimes they don't. And I guess I just go with if this was my grandchild, what would I want to see for them? And if I've got some turmoil over that decision, I go running to the CASA office and they're just wonderful. Sit down and we talk about it. And they don't tell me what to do. But when I walk away from there, I have the support of their wisdom and experience.
Julia, did you have something to add?
Yeah, so our CASAs get a lot of information about the parents and the children in document format. So they learn about what services the parents are doing. They learn about what the kids are doing in school. They speak to the teachers, to the foster parents, to the biological parents oftentimes, maybe to the child's therapist. So they get a lot of information about the child, and they get to know the child. So that is really the key piece, getting to know the child and kind of getting a sense of where they're at and what they need. And that really informs their decision. So they're not making decisions based on, well, the neighbor said, or anything like that. They get a lot of detail about what's happening in these people's lives so that the recommendation they make to the court is well informed.
Go ahead, Charlie.
I try to attend the things that I can that involve the parents and or the children. Family treatment court is just one of the wonderful things that goes on in this county, where it's an incentive program to try to encourage parents to do what they need to do to be better parents. And so I will go and observe what's going on there without asking questions and so forth. I love to get involved in parent-teacher conferences. Sometimes I may be the only person there representing that child for a parent-teacher conference. I go to their kindergarten graduations, and so I try to be as involved with that child and family and the people around them as much as I can to see them in day-to-day, how they're living.
That's wonderful. If you're just joining me, you are listening to a pre-recorded interview about the CLATSEP Court-Appointed Special Advocates Program, or CASAs, and an upcoming training for new volunteers. I'm speaking with Julia Mabry, the Executive Director of CLATSEP CASAs, and Charlie Clayton, a volunteer court-appointed special advocate. I'm Joan Herman on Perspectives on Coast Community Radio. I'd like to talk now about what you're looking for in a volunteer advocate. Are there special qualities that someone should have?
That's a great question. And really, the biggest quality that I look for in a volunteer is an open mind and empathy. So you can't go into this work having a fixed idea of what a good family should look like, what a good parent should be able to do, or having some kind of outcome in mind at the beginning of a case. People have to come into it with an open mind that everyone parents differently, everyone lives different lives. What we want is to find out what's in the best interest of this particular child with these particular attachments in their lives and these particular needs. So we're looking for people who can gather information and keep an open mind about what a child needs.
It sounds like it takes a fair amount of time. Do you put a lot of time into it, Charlie?
Probably the most time-consuming part is coming up on a court or a review board time, and I put a report together. But we're talking about maybe 4 or 5 hours. And there again, I get a lot of help from the CASA office. But on month to month, not in court or something, it doesn't have to be a lot of time. It depends on the case. Some I may want to get around and visit the mother and then go visit the father, the foster home, the child. Other times it's much more streamlined and I just try to see the child once or twice a month.
Do you get to know the children pretty well?
I get to know the children pretty well.
And I imagine they get attached to you and you to them.
I feel in some of the cases, I'm the one constant that they have because I'm the same every day that they see me. Whereas mom or dad may be in or out of trouble, say they will show up for a visit and they can't be found. But with me, they know what they get. Each time I'm going to be a friend and I'll sit and play with them or read or whatever it is that they want to do. And I'm that way all the way through. I think that's the case probably with most of the CASAs is that they can depend on us. They can count on us.
I would imagine when your work is done with an individual child, they would want to stay in touch with you. Have you remained in contact with some of your children?
I have. I've been fortunate to be able to do that. Most of the children that I've been a CASA for have been young children, kindergarten or younger age. And so they get busy and go on, and that's sad for me, especially when I get just what I want in court, and then they move away.
But that's a good problem.
I'm happy that it's worked the way they have, and then I just feel a little sullen for a day or two that I will lose that contact with them. I get very attached to them. I think that's probably the one thing that they cautioned me about from the beginning was be careful you don't get too attached.
Is that pretty typical for court-appointed volunteers, Julia?
Well, we discourage our volunteers to take the role of a mentor and friend too much, because the child will lose that mentor and friend at the end of a case. And most kids that we work with have experienced a lot of loss already, loss of people in their lives, loss of love, and loss of consistency. So we don't want to create a situation where the case is over and the CASA disappears and it's yet another loss. Our expectation is that the CASA visits with the child at least once a month. So they are not a close, you know, it's not like a lunch buddy or like a close friend that picks them up from school every day. Now, some of our CASAs don't always listen to our advice.
Charlie is laughing.
Right. But there are several cases where the family, after case closes, desires that continued contact with the CASA. And then if the CASA is willing, that's absolutely possible. But that's outside of their role as a CASA volunteer during the case.
Fortunately, the CASA office is very good about filling that void with another child very quickly.
Yeah, we have quite a few children in need of a CASA. So when a case ends for Charlie or any of our volunteers, we pretty quickly ask them to take another one.
Before I forget, would you give our listeners the contact information if they'd like to learn more about becoming a volunteer?
Yes, I would love to. You can call our office, and it is 503-338-6063, or you can just Google CLATSUP CASA program and look us up online, and it has all our contact information there as well.
Thank you. You mentioned that there are some 93 children in foster care or in your program in the county.
So there are 93 children in the dependency system, which is the system when the state has temporary legal custody of the child. They are not all in foster care, because some children actually reside with their parents with the state's oversight while the parents are making the changes necessary to be independent, safe, and sober people again.
Are all of those children involved in the CASAS program?
Yes. So our program is appointed to every child in the dependency system in CLATSUP County. We serve all the children. We then assign a volunteer to a child if we have a volunteer available.
Do you have enough volunteers to meet the need?
We never have enough volunteers. So we always have a list of kids that we would like to assign a volunteer to, but we just don't have enough.
And you mentioned that at least nationally, there is some evidence that children, or I guess anecdotally you can see, children who have a CASA volunteer seem to really benefit from that. Can you say, either one of you, a little bit more about that? What evidence do you see, at least anecdotally, that this program really benefits them? Charlie, would you speak to that?
Just in my personal cases, I, as I mentioned earlier, have been surprised at how much influence I could actually carry in the court. I think it's evident in a couple of the cases when that the court can see that the child knows and has a good relationship with me, so that I'm not just speaking off the top of my head for them. And I've seen it go in a positive direction, where I've had an influence over the other lawyers and the judge to do what I thought was in the best interest of child.
And I understand that you have quite a bit of access to confidential information about the child. So that seems somewhat surprising, but you do get a lot of training in terms of how to work with that evidence and how best to advocate for the child, it sounds like.
And how to protect that information as well, yes.
I should have added that to the qualities that we're looking for in a CASA. So that is definitely one. They have to be able to keep that information to themselves and discuss it only with CASA staff and people who are legal parties to that case. So it's not a volunteer job where you can then go to a dinner party and tell people what you did that day. it's people's private lives, very private information, and we respect that.
It surprised me, the information that we have access to, but you think back about the name court-appointed special advocate. It's we're acting on behalf of the court to talk to the schools, talk to the doctor, talk to anybody that has information relative to that child. And it's surprising what we have access to.
Okay. And I would imagine you'd need that information in order to be able to do your work in the courtroom.
Yes, I don't think you could. I don't think I could be nearly as effective if I didn't understand what was going on. Drug treatment, mental health, all those other aspects about where the child is.
What have you learned about yourself, or just about the world in general, the abuse problem, especially involving children, Charlie, doing this work?
One of the greatest parts of this is that we're required to do continuation training, and we do some of that training at the CASA office monthly and some with DHS. And in that training, I think what has surprised me is the horrible effect that drugs have on young people and families. And one of the saddest is to see the effect of substance-exposed newborns who enter the foster system right at birth.
Last thoughts about the program, either of you?
Well, our next training starts on October 18th, and we are definitely looking for trainees. We would love to speak to anyone who thinks that they may be interested. The training is a prerequisite for service. It doesn't mean that participation in the training requires you then to become a CASA volunteer. So if any of your listeners is interested, just give us a call or look us up online, and we're happy to talk to anyone.
I don't know of any other volunteer work that's as fulfilling as this has been.
Well, thank you. I want to thank my guests, Julia Mabry and Charlie Clayton, for coming into the studio and speaking about the CLATSEP Court-Appointed Special Advocates Program that provides a voice for children in the courtroom and the upcoming training for new volunteers. Thank you, Julia and Charlie.
Thank you. Our pleasure.
Julia Mabry is the Executive Director of the CLATSEP CASA Program, and Charlie Clayton, a retired Air Force pilot and Boeing flight instructor, has been a volunteer court-appointed special advocate since 2014. To learn more about the upcoming training, send an email to info@clatsopcasa.org or phone 503-338-6063. This is Perspectives, and I'm your host, Joan Herman. Perspectives was engineered today by Joanne Rideout. The show can be heard every other Friday on the stations of Coast Community Radio. You also can find show podcasts on the station's website. If you would like to contact me, send me an email to perspectives@coastradio.org. Thanks for listening.